Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Healthcare Committee. It is April 11th. We're getting close. So I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2644A. And Oliver, would you explain the bill?
You haven't seen the bill.
Sorry. 26.
Yes.
Okay.
60.
Well, can we just go with that one?
No, because
that's right. Never mind. That's right. Okay.
Why are we doing House Bill
2644? I'll go with this one.
Okay.
We're going. Sorry. Let's close that 2644 and 44 and open a public hearing on 2668, mainly because of people that aren't here that are supposed to testify. 2660A.
2660. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 2660A, brought to you by Representative Bynum.
Oh, I see.
The bill directs the Oregon Health Authority and Department of Consumer Business Services to make written materials about options available on both agency websites relating to breast cancer, insurance coverage, and breast reconstruction options. It specifies that the websites are to be updated annually and outlines items to be contained on the websites. There is a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact. No amendments, testimonies on OLIS.
And is the representative here? Is
there, yep,
yeah,
she's right there.
Yes, there you are. Come, Representative.
Easy to spot in these crowds.
Okay. Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Janelle Bynum, and I am the state representative for House District 51 here in Oregon, East Portland, Happy Valley, and Clackamas. So before working on House Bill 2660A, I personally was unaware that over 70% of women who are eligible for breast reconstruction surgery post-mastectomy are not properly informed of their care options, especially women of color, older patients, and women with limited economic means. So since breast reconstruction coverage has been federally mandated since 1998 with the Women's Health and Cancer Rights Act, HB 266A is a straightforward bill for us. It simply directs DCBS and OHA to provide links to digital educational materials from nonprofit organizations on their individual websites. This provides just one more avenue for breast cancer patients to receive information they need in order to fully understand the healthcare options that are available to them. The bill comes before you and your committee after passing off the House floor unanimously. It is an easy and effective way to increase the well-being and quality of life for women here in Oregon. So I just wanted to thank you today for hearing my testimony, and I hope you'll join me in supporting House Bill 2660A.
No opposition, Representative Bynum?
I dare them. No.
Nicely said, Representative.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank
no
you.
Questions. Okay. Is it Don Stosi? Stose and Melissa Moore?
Yes.
And, well, we'll have you two and then the next two.
Madam Chair and esteemed committee members, thank you for hearing our testimony this afternoon. My name is Don Stose, and I'm a board member for Pink Lemonade Project. Our mission at Pink Lemonade is to educate, empower, and support those affected by breast cancer. The bill before you today will assist women affected by breast cancer in making the best decision for their personal recovery. The vast majority of women diagnosed with breast cancer have no idea what their rights are. Every person diagnosed with breast cancer should have the opportunity to make an informed decision on the best course of treatment for themselves. The bill before you will help them navigate through that process. Please help us help these women diagnosed with breast cancer by passing this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and esteemed members of the Senate Healthcare Committee, my name is Melissa Moore. I'm the office manager for Dr. Alan Gabriel. I'm here today as a female and a clinician in the support of this bill, 2660A. This is a topic I'm very passionate about, and it affects women I see on a daily basis. The Women's Healthcare Cancer Rights Act of 1998 was enacted to require healthcare plans to offer reconstructive procedures as well as breast prosthesis following mastectomy. Almost 20 years later, the majority of women are still not aware of this information. Studies show that 70% of women are not informed of their options at the time of diagnosis. Having breast cancer is a lifelong emotional journey with physical changes and mental challenges, which can have a permanent impact on the patient and their entire support network of family and friends. Restorative procedures are often an important part in making women feel whole again, although it's not for everyone. Some people may choose to wear an external prosthesis or form-fitting bra. Whatever the choice, it is deeply personal and means something different to each woman affected by breast cancer. We are asking for the support to help the women in our state when it comes to breast cancer treatment to consider the patient as a whole by informing them of all their options prior to making the important life-changing decision. Thank you.
Questions for this panel? Pretty straightforward. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sandra Day and Sherry Stokes.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of committee. My name is Sandra Day, and today I share my personal medical journey in support of this bill. Until this year, I had not been so supportive or bold in telling people about my story and women's rights through legislation. I'm 70 years young, and I've just been recently diagnosed with my second diagnosis of breast cancer. I had a bilateral mastectomy 3 months ago and have begun reconstruction surgery. My first breast cancer was in 1996 at the age of 50. I had two identical lumps, one on each breast, and it was very fast growing. My right breast was cancer. My left was benign. So I had two matching scars. That's the last time my breast have ever matched. Because with the right breast, I had aggressive treatment of radiation, chemo, 10 years of tamoxifen and aromycin. And after my first diagnosis, I volunteered for a special research study that was very painful to have women in the future avoid a full axillary dissection under the arm, all lymph nodes removed, because that's very painful and very deforming. So in those years after my surgery, my surgeon then, for the next couple of years, said, you know, I could fix that deformed breast because with radiation it kept getting shrinking, but it would be cosmetic surgery. And I said, no, I don't want the cost and I don't want the emotional journey again. So that was 1996. No doctor until recently ever told me that I could have reconstructive surgery and it would be covered by insurance. The intervening years, 19 years, between the first and the second diagnosis were an emotional roller coaster. I have very dense breasts, and I was recalled after a mammogram time after time for additional diagnostic mammograms, ultrasounds, MRIs, biopsies. So until 2016, I call it my pizza year, because I was sliced up all kinds of ways with other lumpectomies and core needle biopsies. I can't remember a single time over those 19 years that I wasn't recalled. I wasn't like most women have an annual mammogram. I was in the doctor's office a lot. So now I'm before you, and I retired from a Fortune 100 company in management after 33 years. I had excellent medical insurance. Not only having three different states where I had three different medical caregivers, male and female, nobody ever told me I could have this fixed. With exceptionally good insurance, it wasn't explicit in the language what I was covered for. And until recently, with my good friend to the left, very supportive, I decided that I'm tired of being sliced up and amputated basically one piece at a time. I support this bill for women. I want women to have choices earlier and completely and not go through what I did. Nearly 60% of women, when given the choice for reconstructive surgery, choose it. If they are given the choice, about their rights and what it will cost. Let's support women to make these hard, personal, and individual decisions. I have a t-shirt that I really like, and it's kind of like, be brave, be bold, be you. It's very personal. Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming and sharing your story. It's very impactful and takes a lot of bravery, so thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
My name is Sherry Stose. I am a 5-year breast cancer survivor. I am also a registered nurse. I worked in the operating room for a long time. And even though I was with surgeons daily and I have also helped on many surgeries of mastectomies and biopsies, I have never heard of this, the Breast Cancer Act of 1998, until in 2012. I was diagnosed, January of 2012, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I was in that 30 percentile. I was fortunate enough that I had surgeons that informed me of my rights. I chose to have the reconstruction done at the time of my mastectomy, and I truly feel like, for me, that helped me move forward. Breast cancer is a very physically impactful disease, but it's probably even more of an emotional disease. And since you can't separate mind and body, if the emotions are healthy, the body is healthier too. And studies have shown that women that have had reconstruction, their lifespan's a little bit longer because they have a more positive attitude. It is not for everybody. For some, it might be prosthesis, and that's good too, whatever works for that woman. But I would highly like to encourage you to support this bill because women need to know what their rights are. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Questions? Thank you very much. We'll move this after the 18th and schedule it for a work session. All right. With that, I will close the public hearing on 2660. And I would like to, which is the next one then?
2723.
I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2723A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 2723A, brought to you by Representative Solomon. The bill directs the Health Evidence Review Commission to review the therapeutic and clinical effectiveness and cost effectiveness of hippotherapy. It would require the HERC to submit a report to the Legislative Health Committees no later than December 31st, 2017. Sunsets January 2019, declares emergency effective on passage, has a minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact, and there's no amendments.
Okay. And Representative Salzman is?
Solomon.
Who is it?
Solomon.
Solomon.
I don't know. She's right here. She just walked in.
Right here. Just in time.
I meant for that grand entrance.
Awkward silence.
We're looking forward to your testimony.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the Senate Health Care Committee, my name is Janine Solomon, and I am the state representative for House District 30. I am here today in support of House Bill 2723, which would remove the exclusion of hippotherapy or equine therapy from the Oregon Health Plan. I'm going to just speak very briefly. This is a very effective treatment tool for kids with autism, cerebral palsy, developmental delays, and much more. This is a bill that my good friend, Joe Gallegos, a former state representative from my district, he worked very hard on this bill and asked if I would continue and carry the torch and work on this, and I was glad to do so. I was happy to chief sponsor this. I've submitted numerous reports for the record and provide peer-reviewed evidence of the successes of hippotherapy. And just this afternoon, my staff emailed you with a bibliography of all the peer-reviewed journals that provide enough evidence for me to show that this is an effective use of therapy when sessions can be provided on a normal basis. Hence, why we need the coverage. Hippotherapy should be considered merely just another tool for the toolbox for therapists when developing a treatment plan specifically for their patient. I strongly believe that healthcare is a right for all and should not be a privilege for some, and having this exclusion has affected a lot of families, and I've heard from so many of them. It's forced kids to stop their treatment due to cost. This form of therapy serves a broad range of patients, such as kids, stroke victims, like my niece at a very young age, and veterans. A dear friend and co-worker, Karen, has been deeply affected by the exclusion and has shared her personal story of her daughter. It was submitted in written testimony. And I hope that you'll read her story and know that there are many more families such as hers. I want to say, too, that I personally got to see hippotherapy in action. I was able to visit the Forward Stride location and witness a young family, a two-year-old young man who was nonverbal when he came to hippotherapy and getting his therapy through equine movement. He's verbal. He's verbal now. And it was very exciting to see through that type of therapy that he was reacting. And he was reacting in such a positive way, and to understand from my eyes, and I see that it was a ripple effect, because not only was this a strong therapy plan for him, but his two-year-old young twin, that his twin sister was on the sidelines clapping for him every time he got something right, and she was so excited to see her young brother. Really take on something, a real strong, positive direction. And the family support was amazing. And I just am really excited to support such a bill. And I just think there is a beneficial type of therapy that should be accessible to everyone. And I hope that you will join me in supporting House Bill 2723. And I really sincerely appreciate your time. And if you have any questions for me.
Is this when, what's involved in the therapy?
Therapy? Well, we have, and I think I have,
okay,
I have
experts. So they will come and say.
I could just tell you from seeing it, there was
I've
multiple.
I've seen it on TV.
But, oh my gosh, to see it in person, it was incredible.
Yes, Senator Steiner.
Representative Solomon, you and I have talked about this bill several times, and I'm certainly supportive. And one question I never actually asked you was, why do we need a bill to do this? Why can't we just ask the HERC to evaluate this?
I think it was, it's just a natural, like when I spoke with Representative Greenlick, and this bill had taken on kind of a different process earlier on, and he urged me. He was the one that said, please, let's refer it through the process. The natural process is HERC.
Okay.
And this was just a nudge to say, this is important. This is meant for it to be a tool. This is evidence-based. We have story after story and review after review. We're urging you to take this under consideration so that families are not excluded. Like my friend Karen, her daughter had to stop therapy because the plan was she was no longer able to carry that on her insurance. So,
great. Yeah. Any other questions? Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.
And we will have Lori Schick and Jason Birch.
We have some additional handouts. Should we
give it to the committee assistant?
Good afternoon, Chair Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lori Schick. I am a physical therapist and a board-certified hippotherapy clinical specialist practicing in Bend, Oregon. I am here to testify on behalf of House Bill 2723, and I also wanted to mention that it's supported by the Oregon Physical Therapy Association and the Oregon Occupational Therapy Association. First off, I want to start by clarifying what hippotherapy is and what it is not. So what you're getting handed out is just a PowerPoint presentation that's been put together by the American Hippotherapy Association trying to clarify kind of what it is. So hippotherapy simply refers to when equine movement is included as a treatment tool within the scope of a physical therapy, occupational therapy, or speech and language therapy plan of care. Currently, hippotherapy is erroneously classified as an excluded service in administrative the Oregon administrative rules. It is not a service. It is merely another treatment tool, as would be a therapy ball, a swing, another piece of therapy equipment that a therapist may choose. A service implies that it's a separate type or form of therapy, which it is not. It is a treatment tool that's within the scope of practice as PTs, OTs, and SLPs. It is basically using the multidimensional treatment of a movement of the horse to facilitate the neuromotor systems that support and improve human function. Hippotherapy as a treatment tool has been effective in increasing postural control, balance, coordination, sensory integration, communication skills, and improving patients' function and quality of life. Since hippotherapy is not a separate form of therapy or is not a service, there are no hippotherapists. Only licensed and specially trained physical therapists, occupational therapists, and speech and language therapists. It is scope of practice. It's a tool recognized by the American Physical Therapy Association, the American Occupational Therapy Association, and the Speech Therapy Association. And we've been using this treatment tool, or I personally have not, but it's been used since 1970s. The exclusion is also arbitrary in the Oregon Health Plan as to which therapist is excluded and which are not. So the way the exclusion is currently written is that it states an exclusion, it's an excluded service, again, for PTs and OTs, but not SLPs. So it's very arbitrary as who can charge for it and who cannot. This exclusion was put in place quite some time ago, and it was clearly by those who did not understand that it was a merely another treatment tool within the toolbox of PTs, OTs, and SLPs. Unfortunately, the term hippotherapy itself has added to this confusion. So hippotherapy directly translated means treatment with the help of a horse. So it is not recreational in nature and should not be confused with adaptive riding, which is conducted by a certified riding instructor and is teaching riding skills to those with disabilities. Since people confuse these two because they both involve horses and people with disabilities, but they are very different. The therapist is using equine movement as one of their treatment tools to work on functional goals for their patients. A riding instructor is trained to teach recreational riding. Another analogy could be a bike. Like a horse, bike riding is a recreational activity, but when a physical therapist chooses to use a bike as part of their patient's treatment plan, perhaps to help improve the patient's balance, their coordination, their strength, it becomes a treatment tool that is within their plan of care. I think there also may be concern that a tool like this that appears to be very different might add money or cost to the healthcare system. But in fact, that is not the case. Because hippotherapy is not done in isolation, it's done in conjunction with treatment tools and strategies. It falls right within the existing regular fee structures and treatment codes. Therapists are accountable to incorporate it into their own tools and strategies, and for some people, it's highly effective treatment in helping them to reach their functional goals and outcomes. Another area of concern, which may be whether this treatment tool is supported by evidence. As you said, within the bibliography that is on the materials, there is 52 peer-reviewed journal articles in well-recognized journals that document the effectiveness of hippotherapy. In addition, Colorado State University has just completed a systematic mapping study where they have now identified 88 peer-reviewed journal articles, all of which substantiate the validity of incorporating equine movement into a therapy plan of care. In conclusion, I want to emphasize one very important point. It is medical necessity that drives whether a child or adult receives physical, occupational, or speech therapy, not the treatment tool that's used. Hippotherapy is just one of the tools that can be highly effective in addressing the medical needs of the patients we treat. And it's not a miracle cure, but for many of the patients and the populations that we serve, equine movement has actually been the tool that helped them to regain walking, or say their first words, or overcome communication difficulties because of this powerful impact on the human postural and neuromuscular systems. So that is all I have to say. One quick answer to Senator Hayward's question about why the bill. That was how it got started, but also in this scope of what we're trying to do with hippotherapy is not only is excluded in the Oregon Health Plan, but there are specific commercial insurance companies that exclude it. So as a bill that is recognized and goes through the HRC process, then we have a little more leeway to help with some of the other insurance companies like Blue Cross Blue Shield, Aetna, Cigna, who also have those exclusions. So this has been supported by the American Hippotherapy Association in an attempt to really get the recognition of that it is a treatment tool. It's just a strategy within the scope of practice of therapists.
Thank you. Questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, basically what you're saying is that hippotherapy is the equivalent of saying, okay, you're going to be better off getting treated in a therapy pool. And that's a tool that physical therapists use for people who have certain kinds of injuries or whatever, medical conditions, because it's a better place for them to build strength without having the weight associated with it, right?
Correct.
And in essence, it's no different. I mean, it's a totally different setting, of course, and it's got different kinds of costs associated with it, but it's a tool to use and a modality to use that is essentially the equivalent of aquatherapy.
Yeah, I think that would
in
be
the
good.
Hands of a trained therapist of one sort or another.
Yeah, so if a patient comes to me, I evaluate them, and I'm going to look at what are my treatment tools available, what would be the best beneficial thing for them. So I may say, okay, I'm going to put them 20 minutes on a horse and work on equine movement. I may do some sensory integration. I may have some functional tasks that I may do, working on gross motor. So I'm going to develop my plan of care based on my evaluation. And if that tool is available to me, I'm going to use that tool to possibly help with their trunk control coordination integration.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jason Burge, for the record, and I am in support of HB 2723. I'm the executive director of Forward Stride, an organization that employs therapists who use hippotherapy as a tool. We have my main purpose for being here and initiating this bill is really to allow this service to be provided to more individuals, that it's an option that they have that could be very beneficial for them. It may not be for everybody, but if it is, we want it to be available for them. We've particularly seen this with foster youth and other people that might have challenges around or need additional support around community and relationships because of the environment itself, in addition to the therapeutic skills that our therapists are providing, that it goes above and beyond the direct therapeutic skills or the direct therapeutic outcomes is what I see. And bottom line is I really want to make this, would like to have this be available to anybody in Oregon. We are trying to expand and help out more foster youth and more underserved, and this will directly allow us to do that. We have been in contact with HERC, and they've said that they will review this once we move through the Senate. So they've said that they haven't given any indications that it would be they have any objections to it. There's, of course, will be additional process after that we'll have to do. But I'm here to answer any questions as far as a business or what. So I can tell you numerous stories about impacts on kids that we've seen.
So, Ms. Schick, you're from Bend, so obviously it's offered in Bend. Where else is it offered in the state?
So I think, you know, one thing it is limiting in terms of, you know, you need to have horses that are trained for therapy. They need to be a certain size, certain movement. You need to have a team. So with everybody that does this, I have a leader, I have sidewalkers. So it takes a lot of work. So I incorporate my practice within a place called Healing Reins in Bend. Forward Stride's a place out in Beaverton. There's a center in Boring, Oregon. There's one on the coast. There's one in Klamath. I mean, it's not really well served, but there's enough that the desire to do it. We just have to have the horses, and I mean, it takes a lot of work to do it. But there are probably a half a dozen places in the state that currently do it.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. That you had no opposition, obviously, in the Senate. I mean, in the House. Thanks. So, okay. I assume if there's no problems with the bill, we can schedule this for work session too.
Yeah.
After the deadline. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2723. And open public hearing on House Bill 2644A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 2644. It's brought to you by Representative Malmstrom. The bill provides the most effective procedure to be used in the administration of vitamin K to newborn infants. Has a minimal fiscal impact coming over from the House. No revenue impact, no amendments.
All right, Representative Malmstrom, please come forward.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sherry Malmstrom. I'm a state representative from House District 27, representing Beaverton and parts of Southwest Portland, and today I'm here in support of House Bill 2644A. This bill comes to you from the House Health Care Committee with a unanimous do-pass recommendation and from the House floor with only a single no vote. This bill would update Oregon statute requiring that vitamin K be administered to newborn infants infants by the most effective means available. Before discussing the importance of vitamin K, it is important to note that this bill includes an opt-out for parents who do not want their newborn children to receive vitamin K. I want to stress this is not a mandate. While in committee, Kaiser Permanente sent a succinct letter of support for this bill, which sums up nicely the importance of vitamin K. They write, "Vitamin K is a vital medication for newborns and is a required cofactor in the blood clotting process of humans. Vitamin K, administered by injection shortly after birth, helps prevent catastrophic bleeding in newborns. Without it, blood does not clot appropriately, and significant bruising and bleeding can occur with the most innocent of mild traumas to the body. Serious bleeding in newborns often happens in the brain and intestines, leading to serious morbidity and mortality. It is crucial that infants receive a vitamin K supplement shortly after delivery. While you and I benefit from the vitamins in our diet, newborns haven't developed the intestinal bacteria that supplies vitamin K and are at increased risk for the first few days of life. This is a good, simple bill, and I urge your support. Thank you."
Questions for the representative? Okay, let's go with the panel.
Okay. Chairman Sanderson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Benjamin Hoffman. I'm a pediatrician at Oregon Health and Science University. I'm a professor of pediatrics there, and I've been a practicing primary care pediatrician for over 22 years. I'm also here representing the Oregon Pediatric Society. I also am here to urge you to support House Bill 2644, which, as you heard, will help prevent catastrophic bleeding in newborns, the administration of vitamin K through injection. This is the only scientifically proven safe and effective way to ensure that babies do not suffer from catastrophic hemorrhage. This bill has support from the Oregon Health Authority, the Oregon Midwifery Council, the Oregon Chapter of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, in addition to the groups that I'm representing. The law prior to being passed by the House stated simply that a physician or the midwife who is attending the mother at the birth of a child should be responsible for ensuring that the newborn receive vitamin K within 24 hours of birth by the most appropriate means, either by injection or orally. As written, there's an implication of equivalence between oral and injected vitamin K for newborns. The fact of the matter is, it is not, there is no equivalence, and only the injection of vitamin K will help prevent the risk of severe bleeding in the infant. I want to reiterate what Representative Malmstrom said as far as maintaining provider choice and caregiver choice, that this bill will in no way limit the options for a family or for a healthcare provider to provide alternative mechanisms for administering vitamin K. We just want to make sure that families have the best opportunity to protect their babies. I can tell you that I've practiced in the state of Oregon for 6 years. Prior to being here, I was in New Mexico for 15, and never once in 15 years in New Mexico did I have a family who declined to receive vitamin K through injection. The fact that this bill has passed the House and that it specifies the regulation of vitamin K administration and transitions the authority out of statute and into the Oregon Health Authority is something that I'm in strong support of. I'm most pleased with the bill's emphasis on provision of vitamin K by the most effective means and the emphasis on evidence-based practice, because we live currently in an environment that's plagued by alternative facts. And the safety of infants is something that we must consider with the highest degree of scientific evidence. As Representative Malmstrom pointed out, vitamin K is indeed a vitamin. We are not talking about an immunization here. We are talking about administration of a vitamin that is absolutely essential for blood clotting. Nobody in this room would be able to stop bleeding if it weren't for the presence of vitamin K in our bodies. In the same way that vitamin D is necessary for bone health, vitamin K is necessary for clotting. Without adequate levels, for whatever reason, the human being is at risk for life-threatening hemorrhage. We, as older children and adults, get vitamin K through our diet, especially through leafy green vegetables, and actually through the bacteria that colonize our intestinal tract that produce vitamin K that we absorb. The reason that that babies are deficient in vitamin K, number one, vitamin K is not shared by a mother to the baby across the placenta. Human breast milk contains only tiny amounts of vitamin K, and it's not sufficient to protect babies. And because babies are born with sterile intestinal tracts without bacteria, it takes a while for there to be an adequate colony count of those bacteria to produce enough vitamin K to protect the baby from bleeding. What we know is that without the administration of vitamin K within the first 24 hours, about 1 in 100 newborns will suffer a significant bleeding event. And that without administration of intramuscular vitamin K, that risk of potentially deadly and serious bleeding can extend all the way up through 6 months of age. In Oregon, then, we'd be talking about 400 babies a year who might be at risk for this. At present, every single major scientific medical organization, including the American Academy of Pediatrics, the World Health Organization, and the United States National Institutes of Health, recommend administration of 0.5 to 1 milligram of vitamin K as an intramuscular injection at birth. Only this mechanism of dosing, the intramuscular injection, has been shown to decrease the risk for late onset vitamin K deficiency bleeding. This is the most severe of the three types of vitamin K deficiency bleeding. It tends to involve severe hemorrhage in the abdomen, in the lungs, and in about 60% of cases into the brain. This can lead to lifelong disability and has a mortality rate of about 25%. It's incredibly high. And as I've said several times, it's really only the injection that can help mitigate this risk. I've had the misfortune, I've had the tragic experience of having to care for infants who've died from vitamin K deficiency bleeding. And it is something that I assure you I will never want to see again. Despite every effort, despite every intervention we could possibly administer, perfect babies bled to death. And you know, as a result, I've cried with parents who were despondent, and I remember hearing, "If we only knew." I'm here because I want nothing more than to prevent any more needless suffering and pain. And the current law, because it implies the false equivalence between the intramuscular and oral forms of the of vitamin K, will sadly lead to bad outcomes in kids. Currently, only 6 states in the United States permit oral administration of vitamin K, 5 others in addition to Oregon. And we're one of the few states that actually has administration of vitamin K within statute. The way that the bill was proposed initially and the way that it was amended within the House, it completely protects the ability of a family to decline the intramuscular injection. It still enables parents and caregivers to administer vitamin K by mouth, should they so choose. However, I will point out that at present, there is no FDA-approved oral form of vitamin K, and there is no best practice regimen accepted that has been demonstrated to mitigate the risk of severe bleeding and death for babies.
It has?
There is none.
There's none.
There's none. So there's no FDA-approved oral medication, and there's no regimen that's been shown to mitigate the risk. So really what we're asking is to put kids first, to give every kid a chance to thrive. We want to protect babies from a completely preventable threat to their health using a proven, safe, and effective dose of a vitamin. I assure you, I would never recommend anything to a family that I did not or would not do for my own 3 children. And my only goal is to ensure that all kids have the opportunity to thrive. And support of this bill will do that. Thank you.
Let's go with your testimony, and then we'll ask for questions.
Okay. Chairwoman Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is, for the record, my name is Aaron Clem. I'm one of the pediatrics residents at OHSU, and I've come here today to share a story of a colleague of mine who couldn't be here, Matt Dietz. I'll warn you in advance, it is graphic, but it is true. I had only been a doctor in 6 months when I had heard the page overhead, code blue in the pediatric ICU. Code blue means someone is dying and we need help now. I ran down to the PICU and found a 3-week-old coughing up cups and cups of blood, and then his heart stopped. The infant's parents were crumpled, lying, crying on the floor in the corner of the room. We started chest compressions and were able to place a breathing tube and get return of the infant's heartbeat. However, blood filled the breathing tube and the infant's heart stopped again. There can be moments of almost eerie silence during a code, interrupted by a monitor beeping or a call for another round of epinephrine or blood products. At the time, I did not know the cause of this child's pulmonary hemorrhage, but I distinctly remember hearing, "We didn't know," and in between parental sobs. Unfortunately, this infant died. Even more unfortunately, I don't think this infant had to die. This infant died from vitamin K deficient bleeding, something we know we can prevent with intramuscular injection of vitamin K at birth. Worse yet, these parents did not know that the oral vitamin K they were giving their infant is not regulated in the U.S. and does not protect against late onset vitamin K deficient bleeding. You might ask, how could these parents not know? Where could they have gotten such unsound advice? The answer is Oregon state law, which requires practitioners to offer intramuscular or oral vitamin K to newborn infants. We need to change this law, and we need to protect our children.
Questions for this panel?
Yes.
Yes, please.
Past Dr. Hoffman knows all too well the issue of vitamin K in newborns has been known for a very long period of time because under Jewish law and Hebrew scripture, which some of you call Old Testament, you aren't allowed to circumcise a baby boy until the eighth day of life, which is the time when, through natural means, most, but by no means all, babies acquire natural immunity, especially natural levels of vitamin K, especially if they're exposed to a wide range of bacteria. Less true in our modern world because babies are much less exposed to bacteria than they were, healthy bacteria, than they were at the time that the Bible was written. And so this is an issue that humanity has been addressing for millennia, and it's very, very important. I have not had the misfortune of seeing a baby suffer in this way, but having heard about it from colleagues whom I trust and respect, I completely agree with this. And these are very safe injections and should be given to every single baby to prevent this tragic outcome.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, different subject. I just wanted to thank the Pediatric Society for the work you did on the screening program that we're going to be introducing. So thank you very much. That was incredibly helpful. It's always nice to have really smart people involved in something like that.
Thank you. It's all about doing what's right for kids. That's it.
Yes, Senator Knopf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Hoffman, how long has the medical community been giving the vitamin K shot?
In the United States, we've been giving vitamin K for decades and decades, certainly since the 1940s to 1950s. In other countries, it's done in different ways. In most of the industrialized countries, it's given as an intramuscular injection.
So was bleeding prevalent before the injections were known to have an effect, or?
Yeah, Senator Knopf, there are three different types of bleeding that we'll see associated with vitamin K deficiency. There's a type of bleeding that happens within the first 24 hours that generally is associated with maternal factors. So it's often in 2017, those will often be mothers who are on medications that interfered with the function of vitamin K. The bleeding that Senator Haywood was referring to that occurs within the first 2 weeks of life is called classic vitamin K deficiency bleeding. That can be mitigated through the use of oral vitamin K. It's the late onset type that occurs between 2 weeks and generally 4 months, but can go as late as 6 months, that can only be prevented with the intramuscular injection. The fact of the matter is the rates of bleeding overall are about 1 in 100 with no vitamin K administration whatsoever. The rates of vitamin K deficiency bleeding in the late onset, most devastating type with babies who've gotten oral vitamin K is, let me just double check the number, it's about 1 in 100,000. And 1 in 100,000 would mean about 3 or 4 babies a year in Oregon. No, I'm sorry, 40,000 deliveries. Sorry, it'd be about 3 babies a year in Oregon. I apologize. So if all babies got the oral vitamin K, about 3 babies a year would suffer devastating bleeding between 2 weeks and 6 months. So it's not common in the way that ear infections and strep throat and a lot of the other things that, and even not even as common as things like whooping cough, things that we can immunize against. But it's common enough that most pediatricians are at least 1 degree, you know, 1 or 2 degrees of separation away from a case, and it's devastating enough in an otherwise perfect baby.
A follow-up. So, Doctor, what is vitamin K? Is it a natural, you know, is it something that it, is natural in nature, that, or is it a synthetic made up, you know, what actually is it?
Senator Knopf, it is a vitamin. Like most other vitamins, it's an organic compound. I have a picture of the organic structure there if you'd like to see. I could read it to you, but I don't think that would be very interesting. It is absolutely produced in nature. As I said, it's present in a lot of foods we eat, especially leafy green vegetables, and bacteria that normally colonize our intestinal tract produce lots of vitamin K that we then absorb. The issue with infants is that it doesn't cross the placenta. It's not in breast milk. And so babies are dependent upon an adequate bacterial colony count in their gut to start to develop adequate levels. And there are some sociocultural factors in 2017 that make that more complicated for newborns.
So follow up. Mm-hmm. So what is the necessity of moving this from legislative to the Oregon Health Authority?
Senator Knopf, I think that's a really that's a very important question. So from what we understand, and granted, I will the disclaimer is that I've been in the state of Oregon for not quite 6 years yet. In the 1990s, there was a case where a chiropractor attended the birth of a baby and informed the mother that vitamin K supplementation was not necessary. And sadly, that baby died from vitamin K deficiency. And at that point, the legislature, in concert, honestly, with the Oregon Pediatric Society, decided that Oregon babies should receive vitamin K administration at birth, and that was important enough to require it in statute and in rule. But they were also being very mindful of preserving the parents' right to opt out of the administration. I think that's how we got the wording that we got. At present, since the vitamin K requirement and the corresponding Oregon Health Authority rule have become the well-established standard, we can't just get rid of the statute completely because the rule corresponds to it. So what we've done is to take detailed medical practice out of statute, which was at the request of the House Health Care Committee, and ask the OHA to write rules on the dosage and most effective means of administering vitamin K based on best available science.
I have a question. You know, it's difficult for me to want to put medical protocols in statute, but in this case, it's already there.
Right.
So we need to make sure it's right.
Yes, Madam Chair. When that question was posed to me by representatives in the House, that was the response. My response is that it is in statute. I can't go back and speak to the thought process or the reasons as to why. I can explain. I can give you historical explanation. However, what I can tell you is that I'm going to be working in the newborn nursery in the next couple of weeks, and I'm going to be taking care of, 100 plus babies, and it's my most solemn responsibility to ensure that those babies have a chance to thrive. And whether or not the rules exist in statute or in the health authority, this is about doing the right thing. So the fact of the matter is, we have what we have right now, and I'm urging our elected representatives to help us do the right thing for babies.
Thank you. Any other comments?
If I may, Madam Chair, just to clarify, so in essence, not to bring up a difficult topic, but in essence, we're saying that just as the state health authorities' bodies decide on which recommendations to make for school immunizations or other similar practices, they would be making a recommendation based on the best available evidence as to which way was the best way to do this, while parents would still be given the opportunity to make their own choice.
Correct.
This would not remove any autonomy from parents. It would just mean that the health authority was being given the mandate to give education to medical providers about which was the best option. So that they could in turn inform their patients.
Correct. Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward. And in fact, most states have the rules about vitamin K. The vitamin K administration rules are in rule as opposed to statute. It's surprisingly hard to find that information from most states. But I do know of the other five states that mention use of oral vitamin K. None has that in statute. Oregon is the only one.
Thank you very much.
Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just based on what Senator Steiner Hayward said, she mentioned vaccination. This is a whole different thing than vaccination.
It's a whole different thing. I'm just pointing out. It's not a vaccination.
I know. I just want to make sure that we aren't combining the two issues in any way, shape, or form.
I appreciate that very much, Senator. Okay. I was only using that as an analogy when that we empower the health authority to make a decision based on best available. Thank you, Senator. I appreciate that.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Okay, James Barta, did you want to say anything?
I can come now or later.
Let's go later then. Brittany Ruiz, Sarah, is it Odette? And Bob Snee? And then Jordan Ort.
Jordan's not here. She didn't make it.
Okay.
So you can cross her off.
All right.
Come on, bud. You get to be my support. Okay. Hi, good afternoon. Chairwoman Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, thank you for having me today. First of all, Dr. Hoffman, I know that we're not supposed to
Your
be...
Your name.
I'm Brittany Ruiz, and mother of three, I always say that, and I'm here only because I care about the future of our children, the health of our children. And if you ask any person that knows me, I'm passionate about the health of children. And this is all about the health of children. I did want to say that something that did bother me just now on Dr. Hoffman's testimony was that he said there's no other FDA-approved vitamin K tablet. That's actually not true. There's an FDA-approved tablets, which almost all hospitals have available. They find it an inconvenience. It's a company named Mephitin. It's online. You can check FDA.gov, and you'll find it's an approved tablet that's available for children, and it's been used for years, many years. As long as the vitamin K shot's been around, those tablets have been used. So I just want to make sure that we have truth here, transparency, and not misconceptions. Next thing, I'm going to read my testimony. I will want to say first, I want to mention that I'm a taxpayer here in Oregon. I'm also a registered voter, and my husband and I have a small business. We're business owners here in Oregon. I'm very involved locally with legislation to maintain parental rights and the parent-doctor relationship. I'm not paid to be here. I have not been given any financial backing by any major medical organization. I am not a lobbyist. I'm a mom. I'm not paid to come here, which I know some of the individuals, including the sponsor and the organizations proposing this bill, have not only received funding from pharmaceutical companies to support this bill, they are in fact being paid to propose this bill. I'm here out of my heart and what I believe is right. About a month ago, I testified in opposition of this bill on the House side. I had read the entire bill and reviewed the statements against scientific peer-reviewed literature, and it does not stand up. I also interviewed the legislator who sponsored this bill, Rep. Malmstrom, and provided her with the studies after giving my testimony so she can see that her bill does not match up with science. She has continued to push this, making only minor changes to the language. When I asked her what brought her to bring this bill forward, being that there's no epidemic of vitamin K deficiency bleeding and the stats are extremely rare, 1.7% out of 100,000 babies, she said that she was asked to. I could understand the need for a legislator to demand a safer vitamin K administration, but making it most effective means for intramuscular injection is not asking for a safer means. While it may be easier and faster to administer than oral, on the fact that vitamin K intramuscular injection does come with a great risk of death and other side effects, it would seem to be in all of our best interests to leave choice open, not ramrod a bill through just because some vested interest organizations have asked someone to. Per a report last year, which I've included as an attachment to this testimony, we, United States, are the only nation that has the highest infant mortality death out of any industrialized nation. We are also the only nation that pushes and demands and scares parents into getting the vitamin K injection versus oral, which has far less side effects, and also Hep B at birth. In fact, most of the countries who have the lowest first day death use oral vitamin K and do not give Hep B at birth. Starts making you wonder. I also did a survey of thousands of moms on Facebook in several different groups, and of those parents who gave the vitamin K injection, over 80% of their children got jaundice. Of the mothers that gave oral vitamin K, only 20% of their children got jaundice. Of those that I surveyed, a huge percentage of them gave no vitamin K with zero reactions in jaundice. So it's very clear that vitamin K should be kept as an option based on the fact that many parents are different in their wishes, and a lot of them have done extensive research on what route they would like to go. I have included, along with this testimony, three separate studies looking into the differences in effectiveness of both oral versus muscular injected vitamin K. All three studies concluded that both were as effective. One was actually not more effective, one was not less. They were both as effective. Study one from PubMed, comparative study of oral versus injectable vitamin K. Conclusion. It is therefore concluded that oral vitamin K is as effective as injectable vitamin K, and its usage is recommended in our country to reduce complications and costs of parenteral therapy. Study 2, JAMA comparative study on vitamin K with excessive anticoagulation. Oral administration of phytonadione, however you pronounce it, had similar efficacy and safety as intravenously administered phytonadione and may be suitable for treatment with patients with excessive anticoagulation. Study 3, IJSS, comparative study of oral vitamin K in neonates. Conclusion, oral vitamin K is as effective as intramuscular vitamin K, and its usage can be recommended in our country to reduce complications and costs of parenteral therapy. With the above-mentioned science, I will relay my own personal story and why I'm so passionate about not only maintaining informed consent, but making sure all parents know that there is a black box warning for the vitamin K intramuscular injection, but also that they can do oral if they like. On February 7, 2011, I was induced to a rare, and most of you guys, actually, some people on this committee have heard my testimony on this. Rare medical condition called cholestasis of pregnancy. My daughter at the date of the induction was just under 36 weeks gestation. Through amniocentesis, the specialist and my OB both agreed her lungs were totally healthy for induction. My daughter was born happy and healthy February 8, 2011. Previous to that, I was not made aware that there were any vaccinations or medical interventions required following birth. Even in our birthing class, we did at the hospital. The nurse said that they were going to administer vitamin K injection. I balked and asked about it, texted some of my experienced mom friends, and they said it's just a vitamin and nothing else. So I agreed to administer. What followed after my daughter got administered vitamin K1 injection was she started having respiratory arrest. Her oxygen levels dropped, and she was rushed to the NICU for observation. She was kept in a breathing bubble, and later the doctor in the NICU ordered a CPAP for 4 days and oxygen another 2 days. I have included a photo. You can see what my daughter was like in the NICU on those days. She finally got to nurse on the sixth day in the NICU. When I asked the doctors and the NICU nurses and specialists what was going on, they all said, "We don't have any answers. Her test results came back negative for any inflammation or any dysfunction. Her lungs are clear. We will just give her IV antibiotics for the first 5 days just to be safe." Following that, my daughter had extreme hyperbilirubinemia and had to be on the Billy Lights nonstop for hours, so much so that they wouldn't let me do kangaroo care. The OB blamed himself for an early induction, said my daughter was the first baby he had any issues with, and he really thought he did every precaution to make sure the baby was going to be fine. It took me 4 years to heal my daughter from not only that injection, but also 5 days of antibiotics at birth. Whatever good bacteria she got being born naturally was wiped out completely. It destroyed her gut, her teeth. She had nonstop health issues and candida infections and seasonal allergies, and she lost 2 molars as soon as they came in and were decayed. After some years of no answers, I had a friend forward me the vaccine package insert for vitamin K injection. Right on that package insert were the explanations to my daughter's reactions following birth. My pediatrician had no clue that those were side effects. My OB, my family physician, the NICU doctor or nurses, none of them knew. In fact, I have a friend who's an OHSU nurse, and she said she didn't know that those were listed side effects on vitamin K. She works here in Oregon at OHSU. She did not know that. They are not required to review the package insert. They are only told this is something we do after every single birth. Package insert. I'm not going to read you all of them. I've provided you 3 different package inserts for vitamin K. I will just tell you severe reactions for intramuscular injection include fatalities. They include hypersensitivity, anaphylaxis, shock, cardiac, and or respiratory arrest. And this has occurred right after administration. Some doctors just assume, the person's got breathing problems, we're going to just send you the NICU and we don't know what's wrong. They never look at vitamin K. Why? Why aren't doctors looking at the situation that comes up? Why do we have such a huge death rate in the U.S.? Why aren't we looking at that? Why aren't we submitting bills that look at that, except we're submitting bills that take away more options from parents?
So if we're going to tell a parent by law that this is the most effective means and fail to tell them that there's a black box warning on that effective means, we are doing a massive disservice and could maim, cause death, or even cause serious side effects through this effective means. I wish my doctor knew, and I wish, and I would have been able to say that oral is safer because my daughter is premature. Now, I forgot to mention earlier on that premature infants are extremely at risk to these side effects, and that's what it says on the vaccine package insert on all three of them. So my daughter would have been a perfect person to have gotten oral because she was born premature. That was not given to me as an option. So it's a massive disservice and can main cause death, serious side effects through these effective means. I wish my doctor knew and I would have been able to say that oral is safer because my daughter is premature. I was never given that option or education. Chairwoman Monis Anderson, you said during another hearing some weeks ago that you really dislike government telling parents how to raise their children. Well, this bill is doing exactly that. Our newborn babies deserve less medical intervention after going through labor. I'm opposed to HB 2644 as it's written because it's not based on science, but actually based on vested interests, and I hope you do not vote this forward. Thank you so much.
Dear Madam Chair, Mons Anderson and representatives of the Health Committee. My name is Sarah Sultani Gobay. I'm a constituent of District 17, here to testify against HB 2664. It is now estimated that up to 40% of the U.S. population has one or more copies of a genetic variant, MTHFR. My husband and I both have two copies, so we knew our son was going to be born homozygous C677T MTHFR, which makes him more prone to blood clotting issues, among other things. Because of this, I opted out of all forms of vitamin K, and I would like the opportunity to explain why, which I will get to in just a second. It took our naturopathic midwife 4 pricks on his heel to get enough blood for the PKU test. That's how easily his blood was coagulated naturally. Can you imagine what a vitamin K injection that thickens the blood far beyond levels found in any adult might have done to my baby? Procedures that are already in place result in nearly all babies receiving the vitamin K injection at birth. So why are we removing the oral vitamin K as an option for those like me who would otherwise decline altogether? I feel strongly that someday this practice will be looked unfavorably upon, much like the immediate cord clamping is becoming outdated and potentially harmful. This current practice means newborn stem cells have to move through sludge, not nicely greased blood vessels, which make it more difficult for stem cells to make repairs throughout the body. Maybe one day it will dawn on the medical profession that not only are cord blood stem cells important and useful to newborn babies, but that stem cells need thin blood for a reason. This practice was put in place in 1961 as the standard of care. It is estimated to prevent the very rare occurrence of vitamin K deficiency bleeding, but every PubMed article I could find on the subject says that the U.S. does not track the number of cases of VKDB, so we do not really know how frequently it would occur if we stopped giving the shot routinely. Does it make sense to inject every single baby with a one-size-fits-all protocol with something that could harm them to protect them from something that occurs so rarely that we don't even keep stats on it? I also have issues with the vitamin K being used in the shot itself. Senator Knope asked that question and was not given a proper response. It is a synthetic version of vitamin K. It is not the natural form of vitamin K, such as would be found in leafy greens like K1 or butter, which is K2. It is synthetic, the generic name phytonadione. Synthetic vitamins should be avoided as they can cause imbalances in the body and have unintended consequences. For example, synthetic vitamin A actually causes the type of birth defects that natural vitamin A prevents. It is well worth noting that the conventional medicine... noting that the amount of vitamin K injected is thousands of times the newborn's typical level at birth. It seems most odd that conventional medicine repeatedly warns against mega-dosing vitamins in adults, yet doesn't raise any questions at all about the practice of giving a massive dose of a synthetic vitamin to an hours-old infant. I believe babies and all animals, for that matter, have lower levels of vitamin K at birth for a beneficial protective reason, and I'm going to just throw these out there. First, in order to absorb vitamin K, we have to have a functionary biliary system. Actually, you know, OHSU covered all of this, so I can skip this. You understand how it works. But
the stem cells make repairs inside an infant's body, and in order for a baby to get its protective boost of stem cells, cord cutting needs to be delayed, and the blood needs to remain thin so that stem cells can easily travel and perform their functions. Imagine that. A baby has his or her own protective mechanism to prevent bleeding and repair organs that wasn't discovered until after we routinely began giving infants vitamin K injections. Third, a newborn might have low levels of vitamin K because its intestines are not colonized yet with bacteria needed to synthesize it, and the vitamin K cycle isn't fully functional in newborns. It makes sense then to bypass the gut and inject vitamin K right into the muscle, right? Except a baby's kidneys aren't fully functional yet either. Fourth, babies are born with low levels of vitamin K compared to adults, but this level is still sufficient to prevent problems in more than 99%. I believe children have natural protective mechanisms that justify their low levels of vitamin K at birth. I don't know about you, but we should probably figure out why that is before we inject now and worry about it later. Any fetus that gets wrung out like a wet towel while traveling down the birth canal can incur damage in any part of the body, including microhemorrhages in the brain, and needs a built-in fix-it. And stem cells cross the blood-brain barrier. In fact, stem cells can go anywhere. Amazing, don't you think? God's design has solutions for situational problems. Might a logical hypothesis be that thinner blood allows freer and quicker access of cord blood stem cells to any part of the body damaged during birth? After all, why should stem cells have to fight through a baby's blood, which is now thicker than any adult's, courtesy of another needle? In conclusion, I implore you to consider these facts before passing HB 2664, which serves only to give physicians more power to bully parents into accepting the one-size-fits-all standard of care. I understand this is not a mandate, but it does give them the power to bully parents, as many of my friends have been. Thank you for your time, committee.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Robert Snee, and I'm an attorney in Portland, Oregon, and I'm also the co-chair of Oregonians for Medical Freedom, a nonpartisan grassroots organization of Oregonians who believe people have a fundamental right to make informed medical decisions free from government mandates. Like you, Chair Monis Anderson, I agree that medical mandates and statute and rule are out of place. They shouldn't be there. I'm here to testify in opposition to HB 2644. HB 2644 represents yet another government mandate, and now, as a result of an amendment adopted by the House, which takes the decision-making process out of the hands of you, the elected representatives, passes the buck to unelected bureaucrats in the Oregon Health Authority, and instructs them to define a best medical practice for all Oregon newborns. Worse than that, though, the bill takes the decision-making process out of the hands of the parents and their doctor, those who should be most familiar with their medical history and needs. If our legislatures believe it's proper to mandate this form of treatment over another equally effective means, I should ask, what else are we leaving out of government-imposed mandates? According to prior testimony in the House in favor of this bill, since 1961, the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended that all newborns receive a single dose of intramuscular vitamin K. Just last year, in April, in the Journal of Pediatrics, published by the American Academy of Pediatrics, there was an article stating that promoting breastfeeding as the natural way to feed babies should be discouraged because it may lead to dangerous views on vaccination. The CDC also released a paper in 2010 arguing that breastfeeding should be delayed to not interfere with the efficacy of the rotavirus. Perhaps we should have a mandate outlawing breastfeeding for several months after the rotavirus vaccine is given as a best practice to increase the efficacy of the vaccine. I ask that when you consider this bill, look to who the bill stands to benefit, look to who it impacts, and look to who is opposed to the bill. We are a nation of people, not of corporations or trade associations representing those corporations. Liberty loses out in this corporate crony state that we've become living in the current future. As you consider whether this bill would make good law, and it clearly does not, be mindful of this quote from Thomas Jefferson: "But rightful liberty is unobstructed action according to our will within limits drawn around us by the equal rights of others." I do not add, quote, "within the limits of the law," because law is often but the tyrant's will, and always so when it violates the rights of the individual. I urge this committee to reject HB 264 as unnecessary and tyrannical. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
And let me say something. Now, as I understand the bill now, this is the A in gross that's with the amendments in it, that basically a physician will be, or a midwife, is responsible for ensuring that the infant receives vitamin K within 24 hours after birth by the most effective means. Then it goes on to say, to make an objection, the parents then sign a statement attesting that the procedure conflicts with their beliefs and practices as parents. So I still think that that this isn't a mandate. It is going to the parents will still have the right. That's my understanding of reading the A. Engrossed bill.
The parents do still have the right, Chair Monis Anderson. However, it's taking away the option. As I envision what the Oregon Health Authority is going to do once they're tasked with the requirement of promulgating rules to enforce this, they'll come up with a rule that requires that the vitamin K be administered by injection only. And so, therefore, the option of being oral would have to be first refuse under religious grounds the vitamin K objection and then opt for the oral. Whereas under the law as it's presently stated, which probably shouldn't be in a law in the first place, allows the opportunity to opt for oral without opting out of it under religious objections first. It's putting another additional hurdle in parents making the choice and putting mandates in that sense into statute or rules.
Just a minute.
Okay.
Health Evidence Review Commission, the HERC, will be the one who will do this. And Senator Steiner Hayward, HERC is OHA, or
it's independently appointed by the governor.
That's
it's an independent body without commercial support.
Right. Okay. All right. Thank you. Further comments.
I do want to say that just based on what Dr. Hoffman...
Say your name again.
Oh, sorry. This is Brittany Ruiz. Just wanted to comment on what you just said. We already have, in all of my births, which had to be hospital because I had to be induced for the same issue with my first, which is cholestasis of pregnancy, I was able, obviously, through help, get all of my births through 39 weeks. But even with that said, I was bullied to get the vitamin K injection versus oral. And if I said, no, I have my drops... Or I said, can you offer me the oral tablet? And I'm just giving you this right now as an example. The hospital, like an OHSU's example, is going to say, sorry, we don't have that anymore because there's no, quote, FDA-approved tablet, which is not true. So my concern is are we now also not going to make available the vitamin K tablet through this, quote, effective means because we're no longer allowing that oral is as effective as a shot? Because it's saying there that it's not. So I want to make sure that science stands up on this and says they're both effective.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
The tablet is not FDA approved for newborns. The thing that's given orally to newborns is the IV solution of vitamin K, which is also approved for oral use in newborns. The tablet is not approved for newborns.
Archer.
So, and I would appreciate also, Mr. Snee, if you would provide us that. I've been searching pediatrics and the journal since you made that comment. I'd appreciate if you send in the article to the committee administrator because I'm having trouble finding that reference and I'm a little bit troubled by that.
Senator Hayward, I did submit both of the articles and the PubMed article that talked about delaying
breastfeeding.
Mm-hmm. I submitted those electronically this morning along with my testimony, so you should already have access to those.
If not, I can email them to you.
Nope, that's fine. I'll take a look.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. James Barda.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is James Barda. I'm the legislative director for Children First for Oregon, and we have a program United for Kids, and would want to point out that this bill, vitamin K shots for children, is part of our children's agenda because we also believe that this is an important thing that will help save the lives of children. I know there's a rigorous debate among many, but I just want to say a couple comments because I think the evidence was well addressed by Dr. Hoffman. But, it seems scary that something that seems so unnatural would be needed right after birth. But we do so many things now in our modern society that seem unnatural, that we take for granted. whether it's applying anesthesia to surgery or putting a chemical chlorine in our water that saved millions of lives over the centuries. And so this is something that we know saves lives. And we, at some point, need to trust the medical authorities, because it seems like we have all the information at our fingertips when we look on the internet. But in fact, the most important work is behind, you know, a couple different walls. For us, there's the opaqueness of scientific research, which is not readily accessible to most of us. And there's also the fact that most of these studies are behind a paywall, too, which often a person who works for a nonprofit like myself isn't too willing to pay for. But I have looked at some, and having talked with the researchers, I just ask the committee to listen to the experts, the CDC in addition to all the ones that have already been listed, that this will make a profound difference in parents who won't know that, you know, through a terrible luck, you know, not as far chance as a lottery, but, you know, but there is a handful of children each year who are saved by this shot and they'll never even know. And so I urge and I vote on this.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I just read the article that Mr. Snee referenced, and it's an opinion piece. It's not a scientific art review article. And it's just talking about the language that we use to talk about breastfeeding versus immunizations and things like that. I think the authors make some valid points, but all they're talking about is how do we talk about these complicated topics with expectant parents. And it's not condemning breastfeeding as a way to keep people from saying that encouraging breastfeeding is discouraging immunization. It's an opinion piece about how do we talk to parents about it in ways that emphasize the benefits of both. So,
thank you.
Okay, other.
All right, thank you very much. Is that all we have for today? I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2644. And colleagues, please try to be here on time on Thursday. Yes.
That's no fun.
We have a lot of work sessions to get through, and
those are easy.
We're adjourned. And we're adjourned.
Those are easy.
I would.